The seminary's journey toward the fullness of grace and justice is always unfolding. The call to model the inclusive community of God in Christ is clearly before us. And our efforts to live out that call are always incomplete and stand in need of grace and courageous advance. The seminary began this journey in a new way in 1953 when we enrolled our first black student. Our student body has continued to grow in its diversity, as has our faculty and our board of trustees. We have increased our special programs and to increase our cultural understanding and respect for one another. We have broadened our curriculum to encompass a diverse theological perspectives. And the goal remains to create that learning community that is multicultural, multiracial, reflecting the church and our world, and to prepare leaders who are sensitive, aware, and courageous advocates for inclusivity and justice in ministering in church and society. About this week, the first explicitly named African American Heritage Week was held in February of 1992, and the Nathan Baxter Fund for African American Studies was inaugurated on Friday, April 5th, 2002, with a lecture delivered at McCaskey High School by the Right Reverend Bishop Desmond Tutu. Many of you here remember that event. The Nathan Baxter Fund was established to recognize the important contributions made by African Americans in the area of theology, spirituality, ministries of care, worship, and preaching in American religion. Dr. Baxter received both his Master of Divinity and Doctor of Ministry degrees from Lancaster Seminary. Dr. Baxter served as priest at St. John's Episcopal Church here in Lancaster and was dean of the seminary. He became dean of the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and went on from there to become the dean of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. He has previously served as rector of St. James Episcopal Church in Lancaster and now is the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese in Harrisburg. We are grateful for the gift of Dr. Baxter, his leadership and his financial contributions, and his ongoing commitment to Lancaster Seminary, his alma mater. Now about our honored guest, the Reverend Dr. Katie G. Cannon. Dr. Cannon is the Annie Scales Roger Professor of Christian Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in Richmond, Virginia. Previously, Dr. Cannon served as Associate Professor of Religion at Temple University. She has also served previously as Associate Professor of Christian Social Ethics at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and as Administrative Faculty at the New York Theological Seminary. Dr. Cannon has served a term as the President of the Society for the Study of Black Religion, and has the 2011 recipient of the American Academy of Religion's Excellence in Teaching Award. A native of Kannapolis, North Carolina, Dr. Cannon is the first African-American woman ordained in the United Presbyterian Church, USA, in 1974, and the first African-American woman to earn the Doctor of Philosophy degree from Union Theological Seminary in New York. She holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Education from Barber Scotia College and a Master of Divinity with honors from Johnson C. Smith Seminary at the Interdenominational Theological Seminary Center. This past year, Dr. Cannon has been the visiting professor at Union Theological Seminary in New York, teaching womanist theological ethics and codes of ethics in freedom narratives. She has also held other appointments as the Distinguished Visiting Lilly Professor of Religion at Davidson College and the Sterling Brown Visiting Professor in Religion and African-American Studies at Williams College in Massachusetts. Dr. Cannon is the author or co-editor of 6 books and is currently preparing a manuscript on The Pounding of Soundless Heartbeats, a Womanist Critique of the Transatlantic Slave Trade. Dr. Cannon lectures frequently to scholarly and general audiences across the country and at many national universities. We are pleased that this remarkable leader has joined us for this remarkable week of celebration here at Lancaster Seminary. On behalf of the entire seminary community, we welcome you, Dr. Cannon, and are eager for your good words to us and for us. And I invite us now to please join in welcoming the Reverend Dr. Katie Cannon, who will speak on Untutored Salvation, Making Sense of God's Grace in the Lived Lives of Slaves. Dr. Cannon.
Good morning. The first time I said we were doing sound check, this time it's for real. Good morning. Untutored Salvation, Making Sense of God's Grace in the Lived Lives of Slaves. My guess is that some of you are slightly puzzled, undoubtedly intrigued, somewhat baffled, or caught in an intellectual quandary when you hear the title of my lecture for this morning, Untutored Salvation, Making Sense of God's Grace in the Lived Lives of Slaves. Others of you may wonder if the title of my lecture is a semantic paradox or some kind of oxymoron of ambiguity or just a mixed up, shook up verbal quibble that aimlessly muddles and befuddles the brain as we try balancing the peaceful, benevolent doctrine of grace with the vicious, vindictive violence of the transatlantic slave trade. A few sisters and brothers in the audience, upon hearing the phrase, making sense of God's grace in the lived lives of slaves, may question whether it's humanly possible to comprehend God's gift of unconditional love in connection with chattel slavery. Or how do we associate grace with human bondage? How do we couple it with bone-breaking labor? And in turn, we weigh over again and again in our minds whether we are capable as humans to grasp the correlation between the rapping and tapping, the flapping and slapping, the knocking and rocking of hushed, muted, muffled, muzzled sounds of thousands upon thousands of Africans chained together in the bottom of slave ships. As we think about amazing grace, the grace that comes to us, exposing us as individuals to God's loving kindness. One or two among us may even chuckle to ourselves at what sounds like a preposterous, simple-minded, inconsistent absurdity. Not only to talk about salvation among untutored, uneducated, illiterate people, but for me to indicate that the women, men, and children chained in the bottom of slave ships, that the women, men, and children who were dispersed throughout the political economies in the Americas as chattel property over a period of almost 4 centuries, that they, the untutored, the uneducated, the illiterate, that they can teach us a great deal about God's freely given gift, the gift that enables us to affirm even in the most dire, oppressive situations, to embrace our dignity as beloved persons created in the image and likeness of God. Well, the title for this lecture, Untutored Salvation, Making Sense of God's Grace in the Lived Lives of Slaves, was inspired many years ago by a story I heard while growing up in the Cabarrus County in North Carolina. And so I want to share with you this morning 3 stories. And this is the first story from which the title of this lecture comes. There was once a renowned organ musician who was given a concert performance in one of the grand, magnificent music halls in North America. It was back in the days of pump organs. The recital was so splendidly breathtaking that when the musician concluded the first half of the performance, there was a 10-minute standing ovation. So as the maestro walked down to his dressing room, he was all besides himself, puffed up with pride and feeling real good about his accomplishments. The maestro said to himself, "I am wonderful. I am a creative genius. My recital is par excellent." About that time, the black man who had been working behind the scenes, the African-American brother who was laboring under the organ, sending air up through the pipe chambers, caught up with the maestro as he strutted down the corridor. And the black man said to the white man, "Tonight, we're doing a wonderful job. I think this is our best performance yet." The maestro spun around on his heels and angrily confronted the black man, saying, "What do you mean, we? We had nothing to do with it. While I am the accomplished musician, I am the master of technique and artistry. I'm the one who studied for more than 20 years in the great conservatories around the world. I am the skilled musician who memorized all the notes and hit every key correctly. Didn't you hear that standing ovation? Well, that was for me and me alone. You didn't have anything to do with it." The maestro then turned abruptly around, walked with his head erect, his nose in the air, leaving the African-American man alone in the hallway. Needless to say, when the second half of the recital began, the crowd stood up and stood forth another long ovation, even before the maestro had time to take his seat at the pump organ. Eventually, when the maestro did sit down and touch the keys of the organ to resume the concert, there was no sound. The maestro tried again and again, still no sound came forth from the organ. The audience was shocked. The maestro was embarrassed. He kept hitting the keys, but not one note of music chimed forth. And finally, it dawned on the maestro what had happened. The maestro called out his assistant, the black man who'd been working behind the organ even harder than the maestro was working out front. The maestro introduced the African-American brother to the audience and publicly apologized, saying, "Your standing ovations tell me that you really like my music. But you would not hear a note of my music if it were not for this black man, my co-partner, who sends up the air." The two men then went back to their respectful places and finished the concert with even greater musicality. How short are our memories, how quickly we forget. This is the first lesson for us to consider related to untutored salvation, making sense of God's grace in the lived lives of slaves. This first theological concept requires us to be consciously conscientized about our life-led existential realities. The fundamental questions with which we wrestle concerning God's grace cannot be understood nor explained adequately apart from authentic, genuine, wholehearted truth-telling about our various social locations. Yes, conscientization is the first concept we need to embrace. For when we are conscientized, we investigate the stories of our ancestors, our foremothers and our forefathers, the people from whom we descended in this cautionary tale. Let us ask ourselves, with whom do we identify in this story? Where are the women in the story? Where are the children? How do people of faith make sense of such complex dynamics? How do we reconcile honorable memories from our past with historical events that provoke grief and a world of pain? Who are the people who pumped up air so that you and I can be present in this place for such a time as this? Now, the second story is the life story of my grandfather, Emmanuel Clayton Lytle. He was born on August 21st, 1865. My grandfather was the only free child in his family. My grandfather's parents, all his siblings, and all the other ancestors that we know by name lived as enslaved people in the United States of America. when freedom from slavery finally became a reality. My great-grandmother, Mary Nance Lytle, born in 1830, walked for miles and miles, traveling from plantation to plantation, looking for her children who had been taken from her and sold as slaves. So the second lesson in understanding unto the salvation deals with this bottom line fundamental concern known as norm clarification, wherein we research whether or not we possess the internal capacity to wrestle with what it means that the children and the children's children of the oppressor and the oppressed speak a different language when we talk about God's grace. Or even, are we on the same page theologically? In other words, we need to be willing to grapple with the question, can the enslaver and the enslaved serve the same God? Let us ask ourselves, what evidence of grace do we find among the millions of Africans who were seized, chained, and driven along in caravans? Can we who are gathered here in this place, can we bear witness to the merciful pardon that was experienced by African women, men, and children who were branded like cattle, shackled in dungeons of slave castles, some of them with churches built on top, crammed into the bottom of poorly ventilated ships with their faces pressed to the backs of those chained in front of them as they traveled across the Atlantic Ocean? The historical records tell us that the treatment of the slave ships was so harsh and the conditions were so horrendous that one out of every eight Africans died coming to America. There are estimates as well as guesstimates that somewhere between 6 million to 60 million Africans are buried in the watery graves of the Atlantic Ocean. But when we take time to exegete the text, when we read and study volume after volume of slave narratives, we find an implicit definition of grace, wherein people of African descent talk about grace as God's gift of sacred power. A sacred power that enables African Americans to confront shocking, absurd, death-dealing disjunctions in life, so that when we look at our outer struggles and we contemplate our inner strength, we see interpretive possibilities for creative change. In other words, grace is a divine energy that enables us to keep on keeping on. Deborah McDowell, a colleague who's a first-rate literary critic at the University of Virginia, talks about grace as making sense out of what enslaved Black people did with what was done to them. Making sense out of what enslaved Black people did with what was done to them. Howard Thurman, in his book Deep River, sums up grace this way. He said, grace is the ancient memories that lay dormant in the core of our beings, the memories that deepen our knowledge of historical Jesus so that even in the most precarious, death-dealing situations, we celebrate the fact that we are created in the image and likeness of God. Howard Thurman says that if we want to understand grace from the underside, grace in the minds of those who are classified as the disinherited, then we need to ask and answer the following question. How else does the human spirit accommodate the beatings, the torture, the lynchings, the brutalization, and the dailiness of life? Without grace, how long can you hold your breath against such agony? Thurman goes on to say that having no language to carry such memories is final devastation. Even when the death of body comes, it is grace that delivers the soul from dying. When talking about her novel, Beloved, Toni Morrison says that enslaved African Americans transcended their status of thingification, their victimization as objects in the world, by embracing grace as a God-given survivalist intention against the nastiness of life. Morrison says that slaveholders were selling and stealing African-American children at such ages, young ages, that oftentimes mothers and fathers had not formed a lot of memories about their children. Imagine a trauma of giving birth to children and not being able to recognize your children's hands. To have no idea what their permanent teeth look like. No knowledge as to how their jawbones changed over the years. With only saving grace of instinct to guide her, My great-grandmother Mary Nance Liger persisted until she found all her children and she brought the family back together. Some of her children she had not seen in 7 years. When she found them, she pointed and she said, "That one's mine, and that one's mine, and that one's mine." Morrison says that the need to speak, the need to remember, the need to find that which has been snatched and stolen away, the need for that kind of grace is so deep. So deep is the need. If we had more water, we would have made more tears. If we'd had more water, we would have made more tears. Now, the setting for this third and final story pertinent to Unto the Salvation takes place in the 18th century in Boston. Boston, the capital of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, is a symbol of much that has gone into the development of the great American consciousness. For some people, Boston is the cultural center of New England. For others, Boston is the nation's closest link to its European heritage, wherein the people of Boston represent the vanguard of the American Revolution. For still others, Boston's theological influences have pervaded the nations and our seminaries for the past 3 centuries. For most people, Boston represents the focal point of what may be the most diversified and the most dynamic combination of educational, cultural, medical, and scientific activities in the United States. But as for me, a Black womanist Christian liberation ethicist, Boston is important because this is the place where it was first legally declared that Black women are full-fledged members of the human race. In other words, Boston is the place where the great chain of human beingness was broken in two. The ancient construct that arranged all of creation on a vertical scale, from plants, insects, and animals through various races, creeds, and colors of humans to the angels and God, was first called into question in the city of Boston. And the amplified version of the story goes like this. On a bright morning in the spring of 1772, a young African woman by the name of Phyllis Wheatley walked into the Boston courthouse to undergo an oral examination, surely one of the oddest oral exams on record. This test, this ordeal, this procedure was organized so as to assess whether or not it was natural for a Black woman to read and to write. Do Black women and men have the capacity to reason? Can we publish scholarly literature? The bottom line fundamental question was, how could a Black woman who was limited to doing kitchen table ethics obtain an education commensurate to classical education only available to young white men of Harvard? The answer to these questions would determine the direction of life and work of not only Phyllis Wheatley, but also serve as a common denominator of Black humankind. Perhaps Phyllis Wheatley was shocked upon entering the courtroom. There gathered in a semicircle sat 18 of Boston's most notable citizens. Among them was the Reverend Charles Chauncey, pastor of the 10th Congregational Church, John Irvin, a prominent Boston merchant, and John Hancock, who would later gain fame for his signature on the Declaration of Independence. At the center of the circle sat His Excellency Thomas Hutchison, governor of the colony, with Andrew Oliver, his lieutenant governor, by his side. Why had this dignified group of Bostonians been assembled? Why had these men seen fit to summon this young Black woman who was scarcely 18 years old before them? This group that later defined itself as the most respectable characters of Boston had assembled to question closely Phyllis Wheatley's book, the first book written and published by a Black person in America. We can only speculate on the nature of the questions posed to the young writer. Perhaps they asked Phyllis Wheatley to identify and explain for all to hear exactly who were the Greek gods and the Latin scholars she alluded to so frequently in her writings. Perhaps they asked her to conjugate a verb in Latin or even to translate randomly selected passages from the Latin translation of the Bible. Or maybe these gentlemen asked Wheatley to recite from memory key passages from the texts of John Milton and Alexander Pope. We do not know the details of the questions. We do know, however, that Phyllis Wheatley's responses were more than sufficient to to prompt this blue ribbon jury of Boston's finest to compose, to sign, and to publish an open letter to the public, declaring that based on the results of the oral examination of Phyllis Wheatley, that black women can think, that black women do have the capacity to reason, that black women can write and publish scholarly literature. Yes, it was in Boston in the spring of 1772 that Phyllis Wheatley took a giant step in the evil game of May I. So what is Phyllis Wheatley's contribution to the untutored salvation in the wisdom tradition? What ideologies, theologies, and systems of value did Phyllis Wheatley debunk, unmask, and disentangle related to making sense of God's grace in the lived lives of slaves? Well, the final lesson for today is that we need to remember from our foremother, Phyllis Wheatley, is that grace is a power that enabled Phyllis Wheatley to wrestle some form of order out of the crude, chaotic ore of life by speaking truth, a type of truth-telling that womanist scholars identify as emancipatory historiography. In other words, Phyllis Wheatley debunked, unmasked, and disentangled the theological lie that classified African-American people as non-members of the human race. People of African descent supposedly did not have souls. Since the beginning of the 17th century, European patriarchs and their descendants wondered aloud whether or not Africans and people of African ancestry could ever create formal literature, whether African people could ever master the arts and sciences, whether we could ever be an asset to civilization. And the argument of the power brokers ran like this. If Africans and people of the African diaspora can demonstrate the capacity to reason, if we possess the ability to think, to cogitate, to speculate, to deliberate, to create and to evaluate, then maybe, just maybe, our humanity is fundamentally related to the humanity of all people. In turn, no person of African descent would be destined to be a slave, to be chattel property, to be classified as a non-person. And yet at the very same time, African-American people are the only people in the United States of America ever explicitly forbidden by law to learn to read and to write. In closing, I'd like to share with you a scene of untutored salvation recorded in Dr. Rachel Harding's book, A Refuge in Thunder. Dr. Harding makes a case as to how it was against the law for enslaved Africans in the country of Brazil to wear shoes, because shoes symbolize freedom. A British traveler who visited Brazil during slavery time said that everywhere he went, he experienced a strange, eerie, mysterious quietness of the noiseless tread of people walking without shoes. Virtually all transportation, the movement of human beings, as well as merchandise of every description, was carried on the shoulders, on the backs, and on the heads of African workers. And yet these ancestors survived in a world where they were forbidden to wear shoes. It was against the law for them to cover their feet. And even when I was a schoolgirl growing up in Kannapolis, North Carolina, it was against the law for African Americans to try on shoes. The working assumption was that the mere physical touch of an item of clothing by an African American person would make any commodity useless, a worthless waste, a condemned object, a throwaway, a non-sellable good in the minds of white people. So our parents bought our shoes based on guesstimates and estimates, visually approximating the size of our feet. It was very common at the all-black school, George Washington Carver, where I attended, to see boys and girls with slits and strips on the side of our brand new shoes. Our fathers either had to stuff the toe with old rags if our new shoes were too big, or they used their pocket knives to reshape our shoes so they would be wide enough to fit our feet. So even in our contemporary context, descendants of free people continued to make sense of God's grace. For instance, untutored salvation invites each of us. It invites us to covenant and working together so we can discern in the deepest core of our beings the significance of the spiritual composed by enslaved Africans when they sang, "I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes." And when we get to heaven, we're going to put on our shoes and we're going to walk all over God's heaven.
I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children.
going to Q&A.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cannon.
Thank you.
So we have a nice set of time for some questions and opportunities to conversation with Dr. Cannon. If you just raise your hand, I'll bring the microphone to you so you can ask your question.
Good morning, Dr.
Good morning.
Would you say something to this group, because you mentioned it in passing, well, yesterday in the class, about why story, why the telling of stories to get at ethical issues, theological and ethical issues?
Some of you will be coming to the book signing, will be buying copies of my book. And the first book I wrote was, it's entitled Black Women as Ethics, but it was my dissertation. When I first joined the Society of Christian Ethics, and I made the statement that if you're black, poor, and female, you don't have the same range of choice and freedom, range of choices and freedom as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant man of wealth. And I was the only black woman at the meeting at the time, and the white men said, that's not true. And I said, what do you mean it's not true? They said, we all have the same range of choice and freedom. I said, it's not true. If you're black, female, and poor, you don't have the same range of choices as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant man of wealth. And they said, where is it written? So I wrote it. Because that's what makes the Phyllis Wheatley story so powerful. Because since the Enlightenment, if it's not written, it doesn't exist. So if you're reading these texts while you're in seminary and you say, my story is not present, then write it. We're responsible for putting our story as part of the discourse. And a lot of times, people don't want to believe the truth. I was talking to Dr. Hicks about this as well as Dr. Bridgman, that sometimes the black reality is so painful that people have to read it only through fiction. Like when I teach my course on codes of ethics and freedom narratives, I use slave novels because people won't read the narratives. Because there's something about the novels that allow people to go into the Holy of Holies in a way they can say, this is not true, this is not true, this is not true, this is not true. But when they get it, but they know it's true, but it gives permission to look at the horror, the terror, the trauma in a way that the true story, people back up from and say, it hurts too much. So in my teaching, I use a lot of stories, a lot of fiction, because it helps people enter into the heart of the story and live and vicariously try to feel some of those feelings that they back away from when it's nonfiction. I even have a lecture I do called Black Women's Literature as Sacred Texts, and I open up the canon. I play with the word canon, right? Katie's canon. So to talk about all of our stories matter. You know, one of the things that separates theology from philosophy is that philosopher asks, is there God? Theologians start with two presuppositions. God is and God acts. God is revealing things today that's never been revealed before. And it's up to us to record those stories and bear witness to those testimonies.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Gaffney.
Can you say something about the ethics of having to have your work evaluated by people who don't value and respect you? I think both of Phyllis Wheatley's interrogation, which did, of course, not put an end to interrogating black bodies and black women's bodies for signs of intelligence, and then your own narrative about having to write the book because the knowledge wasn't real unless it's written, how we as scholars support that kind of hierarchy of written sources over oral sources, yet we need to do that in order to be employed and employable. Can you talk about that?
Thank you. Be glad to. Thank you. One of the things, as a person who loves mentoring and advising my doctoral students, and I tell them we have to be multilingual and multicultural in our thinking all the time. When I was at Union, New York, and as a doctoral student, I took a course on the passion narratives with Raymond Brown. And they told me he was the leading scholar on the Gospel of John in the world. So I wrote my paper on the agony of Gethsemane. And he said it was so bad he couldn't even flunk it. Now, you know that had to be bad. It's bad to make an F, but it's so bad he can't even put an F on it. And I said to him, what's the problem? He said, how dare you evoke feeling? Now, the paper was the agony of Gethsemane. The agony in Gethsemane. And it was like, so I went to Dr. James Conan. I said, what am I supposed to do? The man said, it's so bad he can't even flunk it. He said, he's the leading scholar in the world in the Gospel of John. Find out what he wants you to do. So I had to learn how to neuter the paper. I had to take all deep, make it dispassionate. I had to make it experience distant. I had to flatten it out so that Dr. Raymond Brown couldn't feel any feelings. And it was like, I then learned how, that's the multilingual I'm talking about. Sometimes you can write from in your mother tongue and it's all about, you gush. And then other times, the gushing is so offensive to people because it means what goes from the heart comes to the heart. As you're touching it, and they don't want to be a heart. They don't want to feel feelings. They just want to be a talking head. And so the power brokers in the academy still demand that of so many of us. The flatten it out, neuter it out, bleach it out, and then it's good. And so, but part of what I try to encourage anybody I mentor is you got to be multilingual. Is that you got to know how to do that and also maintain your mother tongue. You know, and what happens is Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, those of you who know the group Sweetheart in the Rock that she founded, she said, we all will mortgage ourselves, but we can't let foreclosure happen. You know, and that's a hard thing in ethics to try to understand that we're all going to have to compromise and do a ministry. You know, there are moments when you go like, sometimes I sit in a faculty meeting and some injustice stuff might be going down. I have to let that one go. So I have voice on the next one. I mean, Michael Vick messed it up for us. I mean, because we used to say you can't put your dog in every fight. So I don't know what the new metaphor is. But it's that sense I'm talking about. It's that you can't, even when you know you're the pastor, the educator, you're the leader of the church, and you see injustice, you can't fight them all. You can't, because then they just null you out, and then here she comes, here he comes. And so you have it's the discernment that comes from, as they say in the 26 12-step programs, God grant me the wisdom to do what? The courage, the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change, and the wisdom. Now, how many of us spend our energy trying to change what we can't change? Not, you know, and so it's like that's the prayer. It's a, God, now do I get into this fight or do I leave that one alone? Do I speak now or not? And then a lot of times, see, I'm one of those Jacob people. I'm not one of those people who, like, when ministry happens, says, oh, I can't wait to do ministry. Hey, Hercules. I'm like, God, I got a list of people for you who can do this. And then it's like, and I'm going like, is it my time again? I mean, Dr. Brisman can do this so well, God. Let me give you her name and her number. And God said, no, it's your time again. And so one of my friends who's a physician says that the bone that gets touched in Jacob is the most solid bone in the body. It's what Paul Tillich talks about, being grasped by that ultimate concern, or some of the psychologists talk about having our massive motives changed. And the New Testament writer simply says, we're born again. I wrestle all the time. I'm one of those, that's my metaphor for ministry, wrestling with the angel. It's like, well, I'm going to lose every time, but I keep wrestling anyway. As Dr. Gaffney was saying, the politics, as I tell my doctoral students, getting a PhD is 75% political. You can be the most brilliant person in the world and you can't get it. You can be mediocre and get it. Because it's like, well, it's different for men than for women. And then you bring all the racial ethnicities into the configuration of our embodiment. So many women come into the program and it's like, we know what we want to do, but we don't believe it's rigorous enough. So why go through the door if you can go through the wall? And then we wonder why our heads are bowed and bloody and got mired. It's like, because we've been socialized not to believe what we know has value. When I first started my PhD and I got put out of the Hebrew Bible program and started over in ethics, and I started working with my mentor, Beverly Harrison, And she would say, I'd write about all these dead white men, and she'd say, Katie, we know that already. And I was like, this white woman's trying to trick me. And she said, you can't be a better white man than a white man. You can't be a better black man than a black man. You can't be a better white woman than a white woman. You're a black woman. You bring something to the academy we never had before, and that's what we want. I said, why is this woman trying to sabotage my degree? Everybody know you got a mass of dead white men. She said, but we know that already. So finally, about the third time, I said, I'll just leap on faith. You mean to tell me what my mother, my grandmother talk about? That's the stuff? She said, that's the stuff. She said, that's the goal? I said, yeah, that's goal. And that's when I started writing it, because no one had ever affirmed that what I knew organically in my formation was valuable. And so part of the socialization for so many women I advise and talk to is that which we know in the core of our beings, in our bones, that's the stuff. Now, what happens with so many men I advise is the socialization of being male in a patriarchal society is that they think they're water walkers. You know, it's like they don't want the door or the wall. Just being makes them wonderful. It's like, wait a minute. You got to produce something. You know? I think, therefore, I am. It's like, no, you got to produce me some work. I need evidence of your thoughts. You know, it's like, I mean, the socialization is so different. You know? We're working, running around the track 3 or 4 times, only need to do one lap, and we still galloping around. And then the young men come in and go like, am I not wonderful? And I say, I have no evidence. I need, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I need exhibit A, B, C, and D. Other questions, comments?
Another question? Surely there's got to be another question in here.
Well, I got a question on the email this morning from somebody who was at the master class yesterday, wanting to know the difference between what does Alice Walker mean when she says that woman is the feminist as purple is the lavender. And it's not to dismiss the struggles that women who are not of African descent go through. It's just saying that the level of struggle is different. The same thing I experience whenever I leave this country and go meet with the sisters on the continent of Africa, my purple becomes lavender. I mean, because when you're dealing with walking 2 or 3 hours to get water, or asking, trying to find where clean water, just the basics that I take for granted, I understand the complexities very differently. And it's that kind of sensitivity Walker is asking us to think about. What does it mean to grow up in a culture where if you are of one ancestry, you're automatically given status and privilege of being superior. And if you're born of a different lineage and ancestry, you're automatically assumed to be inferior. As if God ordained it that way. And see, that's our work as theologically educated people. See, we're not to be the psychologists, the sociologists, anthropologists. Our work is to break open the theological lie that God has ordained inferior people. That's a lie. And see, if we don't teach people that that's a lie, it stays as a false truth, you know. And sometimes we get caught up doing other people's work, but our work is theological work, trying to crack open the lies that hold oppression in place, the theologic of oppression, you know. And so when people say, but God ordained it that way, I mean, what other higher authority do you go for? And we have to say, God did not ordain it. For 92 days, I had a 14-year-old girl living with me, and I counted every day. That's how I know it's 92 days. I didn't even know how much my mother's voice was in me until that child was in my house. And so I said to her, I want you, and it was Nikki. I said, Nikki, I want you in this house. I was living in faculty housing in Cambridge at EDS. I want you in this house when the street light comes on. She said, why? So I tried to come up with every logical thing I could think of. And she said, why? And so finally I said, because God told me. She looked at me, she said, God told me something else. I said, now, do you want to go back to your mother or your grandmother? You're out of here. I was like, because she pulled her authority, I pulled mine, and she trumped me. So I didn't want to say that.
First time I've had the privilege to hear you speak, Dr. Cannon, and I sit here overwhelmed and almost in tears because of the grace that you exhibit and that black women and men exhibit such grace in being forgiving to those who have persecuted. And this legacy is so powerful and shaming to us who have our foremothers and mothers, and mainly fathers probably who have, but foremothers as well, who have perpetrated such pain and ignorance in the world. And, you know, you kind of, it is the answer, the serenity prayer, accept the things that you cannot change. And, you know, that when I heard you speak about having to take the power, well, I'm sure you left power in your paper in the, you know, there was agony in your paper, even though you had to take dispassionate, take the passion out of it. What that entailed and how you did not, I'm sure without asking, you did not remove any, you didn't compromise yourself to do that. But how one would even accomplish such a thing, I can't even imagine. The title of your lecture is about grace, and I think it's just the way that your culture and my culture as well, that has survived and thrived and kept going. I'd love to hear more about the teachers and how you accomplished that.
Thank you. The reason I translated it into being multicultural, multilingual, is because I did feel like I was compromising. I had never known how to take the agony of Gethsemane and now have no agony in the paper. But I learned how to do it. And that was when it's like, okay, I got to know how to speak the language of academies so that the people I represent, like when I was having the most difficult time in my PhD program, I wrote a paper, and one of my professors said to me, who wrote it? And I said, I did. He said, no, this paper's too good. Who wrote this paper? And I said, I did. And by the third time, I didn't know who wrote it. I was so discombobulated that the moment from that point on, I had to go to the register, change the grade from a grade to a pass-fail, because every time I walked into class, I got muscle spasms. My body would just lock, my spine would lock on me. And I'd never experienced that before. So I had to learn. I'm in the world where I got to learn how to function. And when I would call home and say to my mentor at college, down in Nova Scotia, she said, you're not there for you. You're there for all of us who will never be there. You're accountable to a whole lineage of black people. And then I called my mom and said, Mom, I don't think I can do this. She said, you know they're hiring at the mill. I said, I think I can do this. I think I can stay here and do this. I think I can go to the library a little longer, because I couldn't work in County Mill. I tried to work in County Mill one summer, and I had a nice job. My job was to hem pillowcases. And this was an upgrade for a lot of, because a lot of black people didn't get to work on the sewing machines. And yet, but we were on, you had to make production. You had to hem like 2,000 pillowcases in 8 hours. And you had 2 10-minute breaks if you smoked. And since I didn't smoke, I took a book of poetry, Nikki Giovanni. And so during the 10-minute break, I brought out my book of poetry, sitting at my sewing machine, minding my business, trying to stay sane. And the word went through the mill. There's a colored woman up there with a book. Well, it was an embarrassment to the family, because everybody in our family had made production at Cannon Mill. Even my drunk uncles could make production. It was like, who do you think you are taking a book to the mill? I was like, I didn't smoke, so I thought 10 minutes of reading books. Well, I didn't, that was a big deal, you know, and to have a book, back to the etiquette. So I never took a book back in the mill. They would get ready to fire me. You get 6 weeks on probation. They were going to fire me that Friday because I couldn't make production. that Wednesday a call came from the Catawba Presbytery saying, we need a young person to go to New York and be representative on the Fund for Self-Development People. And Dr. Elo Henderson said, are you articulate? I said, yes, sir. I didn't have a clue what the word meant. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, pack your suitcase. Tomorrow morning, you get on Eastern Airlines, you fly to New York. I said, there's a God. Because then the whole family didn't have to be embarrassed by Friday, because no one in our family had ever been terminated from being able to work in the mill. Everybody, like I said, could make production. So then when my mother said, you know, they're hiring at the mill, she knew that was enough impetus to say, oh, yeah, I can do a PhD. I would stay here and do this PhD. And then when my mentor, Ms. Portia, would say, you're not there for you. This is not about you. You're accountable to a whole lot of other people who wished and who have sent you forth to do this. She said, when they've given out music, that's why I had the musician to sing, I got shoes. She said, they didn't give you voice. And when they were given out, she named all the different talents. She said, you have the talent to think. So that's what you have to do. So that's why I mastered, they stayed in the program. The way I teach, and one of the greatest honors of being getting this award this in November from the American Academy of Religion, Teaching of Excellence, is that I have all the ways black teachers taught me. I was in black schools all my life until I got to Union, New York. And black teachers always said, I'm going to give you the best I got, and I want you to be better. And so it wasn't about cutting people down. And so when I got to Union, New York, for the first time I was with people whose parents were writing the books we were reading, our grandparents, and it was a whole different class of people, both black and white. I mean, a lot of the black men and women at Union had been in the prep schools and the Ivy League schools and the Seven Sister schools, and so they had already acculturated and understood white educational culture that I didn't know. So because I had been told, everything I got, I want you to be better. I'm going to give it to you. And so I remember sitting in Sam Terrian's class, and he asked, and I raised my hand, and he said, and what book have you written? It was like, I didn't know you couldn't talk if you hadn't written a book. Everybody was taking notes. I didn't know that because everything was so dialogical in my experience. And so that's when I had to start therapy because I didn't have a clue. I mean, I laughed at the wrong time. I talked at the wrong time. I mean, I'd be the only one laughing. It's like it was. So I had to find, and so my therapy was not because psychological. It was like I had to learn how to get in touch with my white self. I had to learn how to act, how to read that invisible transcript because I didn't have a clue. So that was the grace that I learned from black teachers. I don't cut my students down. I'm a co-learner with students. It's not about embarrassing them. It's like the teacher, I remember I was so anxious to learn when I got to seminary. Every time we call my professor, a Hebrew professor, we call him Dr. Yahweh, Dr. G. Murray Brandt. And I was talking to Brian this morning as we were coming over how some of the brothers in seminary, one-third had I had just come back from the Vietnam War. This is 1971. One-third was in seminary to keep from going to the Vietnam War. And then there's one-third that had been identified as war preachers. Since there were three or four, somebody said, you're going to be a preacher. And then here we were, 10, 15 black women, 20, 21 years old, going to seminary. And these men thought we were there to get husbands. It's like, why would they think that? They really thought a lot of themselves, right? So we said, we're here to study theology. They said, yeah, right, you're here to get the MRS degree. It was like, in 1971, those of you who weren't born, but those of you who were born, you will know, in 1971, the two people you didn't want to marry were preachers and police officers. You know, it's like, but they really thought that. Okay. So we were in Dr. Yahweh's class, and he had talked about the Red Sea or the Reed Sea, and then we went to New Testament, and they were talking about the resurrection story and that kind of thing. And this one guy said, you've taken my Moses. Please don't take my Jesus. And he was just crying. And that kind of engagement was welcome at ITC. And so we would raise our hands. And as soon as Dr. Yahweh would start talking, I had my hand. He said, go to the library, read this, read this. And so I was never ridiculed. I was never put down. And so when I'm teaching, before I open my mouth and the student got the hand, I said, that's me. So I have to be kind to that person because I remember that kind of hunger. The intellectual hunger, just trying to find meaning. Because I went to seminary as a person, I didn't go as a God struck me dead person. I went to find out if Christianity was a slave religion, if it was that which was holding black people back. And within the first week, I realized It was the most liberating source we needed in the black church community. But I would have, if I found out it was a slave religion, I was going to be on the front saying, we got to give this up, y'all. This is killing us. And found out it was just the opposite. But what I found out, so much of the liberating aspect of theology and religion wasn't being communicated to the people in the pew. The people weren't understanding how liberating the gospel is. You know, and it was during that time when they said, it's a sin to wallow and shuffle. It's a sin to allow anybody to tamper with the image of God that's in there on us. You know, and it was like, oh yeah, I like this. I can be here. It's like, and say, but I did not want to be a minister, because the only women ministers I knew condemned everything that was fun and joyous in life. I was 21 years old. You know, I was like, why would I want to be a minister? And then they said, I said, okay, I can be a minister if I just talk to other 21-year-olds. They said, okay. But I went to seminary to get a master's in Christian education, because my undergrad had been elementary ed. And Dr. James Costin said, if you get a master's in Christian ed, the only thing you can do, this is step they want, is work at the Y. I said, work at the Y? They don't even allow people to go to the Y in my town. He said, that's right. I said, I'm going to get a master's and I can't even go in the building. He said, that's what sign me up for the MD of then. If you know, I didn't know what I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I didn't have a clue. I said, well, sign me up for the other program. I'll do that one. At least I can go in the building, I thought. God has a wonderful sense of humor.
Amen.
Is it time?
Yes, I think it's time. Thank you so
one
much.
Last question. That's a burning question. We can't quench the spirit on that one.
Thank you for your good words and thoughts. It's been said that scholars and historians shouldn't like look back and say, what if? But if you could, I'd love to hear what you would think of what America would look like today if post-Civil War, the most radical Reconstructionist, of which Thaddeus Stevens of Lancaster was the forefront, what would America look like today if Reconstruction had taken place and black folks had had free education and access to property ownership at that time period, and somehow the Southern white folks wouldn't have rose up against that and allowed that to flourish?
I'd have to answer like Dr. James Cone would say, the Commonwealth of God would have been at hand. It would be ushered in an eschaton. We can't imagine it, because it went so, that Reconstruction, the way they shut it down, and the backlash was so severe that we're still overcoming it. We're still, even now when people talk about we want our country back, it still feels like we're in that nadir period again. The lynching period. I mean, it was so, when the retrenchment after the Civil War and Reconstruction is moving forward, and then the way they destabilized it so severely that even in 2011, we're still living with the consequences of that. So, grace. Grace. Amazing grace. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming this morning and for attending this lecture. We encourage you to come to the book signing at 4 o'clock in the refectory. The event this evening at 7 o'clock at Star Auditorium with Dr. Cannon and Nikki Finney. Thank you so much.